Hello, I'm Dr. Cosme McKinley. I'd like to tell you about a new film from the gang that gave you the Rocky Horror Show. Shock treatment. Trust me, I'm a doctor.
I'm not a locomotive to suit you myself. I've been a cynic for too many years. Playing doctor and nurse, it can be good for your health. I've seen clinics with those gimmicks in Tangiers. But if you open your heart to a smooth operator, he'll take you for all that you've got. He'll hand you a purse that'll be with you later. It'll shake you the way he takes off, like a shot. You need a bit of
shock treatment.
Get you jumping like a real live wire. Need a bit of
shock treatment.
So look out, mister, don't you blow your left resistor for a sister that'll certify ya.
Fire, fire, fire.
Welcome back to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Hello, Governor!
This week, we're discussing the movie musical Shock Treatment. Now, I'll tell everyone up front that this is a rather selfish show for me, as I'm showing the movie Shock Treatment and Miami Blues on the first night of my summer book tour. Both these films are being shown in 35mm at the Tribeca Theater at 200 Hudson Street in New York City on Friday, May 27th. And I can't wait to see these movies on the big screen.
So are you going as Crockett or Tubbs?
That's not Miami Blues.
Oh! Oops!
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Well, I'll buy that for a dollar.
Oh, nice, nice. It's a little bit more than a dollar, I'm afraid. But now that the commercial shill is over, let's start the show and talk a little bit about the movie Shock Treatment. Shock Treatment was the sequel to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And if you didn't know that Rocky Horror had a sequel, that's not too surprising. Rocky Horror was a phenomenon that really brought the whole midnight movie craze to light. Before Rocky, there were midnight movies, of course, yeah, like El Topo. But Rocky Horror hit a note with audiences where people would come in dressed up as the characters or interact with the screen. It was this whole communal movie watching event. And that was kind of the fan base that 20th Century Fox said, oh, hey, we'll cash in on this.
So wait a minute. Maybe you can shed some light on this. I actually read that Richard O'Brien, the guy who created Rocky Horror, he approached a producer of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, who happens to be named Michael White, perhaps one of your doppelgangers, to do a sequel for Rocky, which was called Rocky Horror Shows His Heels.
Right. And that story had Frankenfurter coming back from the dead and transform people into transvestites and stealing Janet's baby and sucking the blood out of young men. And apparently, director Jim Sharman kind of put the kibosh on that. But the songs from that whole thing just kind of stuck around, as if O'Brien had written these things and really didn't want to scrap them. So instead, they got shoehorned into what would become Shock Treatment. The basic example of that I can give is the song Looking for Trade. You know, in Rocky Horror Shows His Heels, it's Frank out looking for young men so he can get their blood. And then it kind of gets recontextualized in Shock Treatment, and Janet is singing it. So it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But before I get ahead of myself here, I should really try to sum this movie up, which I would say is a little bit of a Herculean task. So bear with me. So everything in Shock Treatment takes place in a television studio in Denton, and that's the original setting of the Rocky Horror Show. And in fact, the only person to reprise their role from Rocky Horror was this guy, Jeremy Newson, and he played Ralph Hapshot.
Hapshit.
I was waiting for that one. So Rocky Horror starts at his wedding where he married plain old Betty Monroe. Anyway, Brad and Janet show up at this studio, and they're chosen to be contestants on this show called Marriage Maze, where it's revealed that they're having a little bit of problems in their marriage. What are those problems? We never really find out exactly, but it's safe to say that Brad's not performing well in the bedroom, and I would say go further to say that he's having some sexual identity issues after his encounter with Frankenfurter, but whatever. So Brad gets thrown into the loony bin, which is actually part of another show, this medical drama called Denton Vale, while Janet gets all these prizes and she gets this whole transformation and blah, blah, blah. And all of this is done to the bidding of the new sponsor of Denton Vale, Fast Food King Farley Flavors, who is, of course, Brad's evil twin brother. Hey, you know, and he's vying for Janet's affection. So that's the A story, believe it or not. And there is a B story that has Betty Monroe. She's got divorced from Ralph. And this guy, Judge Oliver Wright, who's played by Charles Gray, who was the criminologist from the first movie. And in this one, he actually gets to interact with all the other actors, which is kind of nice. And they investigate the goings-on at the station after Betty's show is canceled. And yeah, it's like a whole like detective story happening there. So everything that's going on is kind of being broadcast, but sometimes it's difficult to separate what the television audience is seeing versus what we're seeing as the audience. And so, yeah, that's what I got.
So now that you've brilliantly summarized the film.
Why, thank you.
Which you said you couldn't do. This was your pick this week because I would never pick this movie. But anyways, it was your pick. Why did you pick such an atrocity?
Well, I'm glad you're not going to hold back. Despite its flaws, and there are a lot of flaws with this film, I still like the movie. I will admit, the first time that I saw it, I thought it was absolute garbage. I rented it on VHS, watched it, and I was like, what the hell is happening here? Because it's supposed to be kind of a sequel to Rocky Horror, but then you've got some of the same actors who are reprising different roles, one actor who's reprising the same role, and then you've got different people playing Brad and Janet. You've got no Frankenfurter in it. And yeah, it's just like absolutely bizarre. So I won't go so far to call Shock Treatment a fascinating failure because there is a lot of stuff that I do like about the film, but I have a lot of problems with it. One of them speaks directly to what I was just talking about before with the songs. The songs are terrific, but they don't really fit with the story. Like Janet out looking for trade, it's like not really. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with the term rough trade for like, you know, young gay men kind of thing.
I wasn't familiar.
You weren't familiar with
the game
of
trade angle, sorry.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, that's why it's always cracks me up that the Smiths were on a record label called Rough Trade.
No, I know. I'm just giving you a hard time. I remember I first learned of trade, yes, a la John Waters.
Oh, okay.
So he's been my gay, teacher. Ah, many levels all these years.
So, I mean, like I said, though, I like the song, and I like about probably 90% of the songs that are on the soundtrack. The film's beautiful to look at. It's, you know, this kind of like candy colored dream kind of thing. And then it's fascinating for me to see like the whole like televised world that it portrays. It's like the musical version of William Klein's The Model Couple, but, you know, just a lot more pretty to look at. So, and then there's the whole media cynicism and the critique of, you know, television, and that endears it to me as well. But I will say, though, that had I not read L. Rob Hubbard's article about Shock Treatment and Cashier's Cinemark 14, I wouldn't have the appreciation of the movie that I do, because I, like I said, I hated it. But then I read the whole making of the movie and the way that it could have been and the way that it turned out. And that's kind of fascinating to me. So, you know that I'm a sucker for that whole, like, what this movie could have been. So knowing the history of it added something to the whole experience that's lacking from the film, just standing by itself. Having gone in knowing nothing, I hated it. Having gone in and knowing the history of it, I enjoyed it more. It's still not quite there for me, but there are a lot of things that I really dig about this film.
It's funny you mentioned, actually, 2 points. One, is L. Rob Hubbard, is that L. Rod Hubbard's cousin by chance?
It's this guy, Robert Hubbard, and then he went by that for the, I thought it was a pretty cool nickname.
Did you ever have a writer named T. Yasmus Switters by chance?
No, I did not.
Oh, damn. Anyways, and then it's funny you mentioned William Klein, because I, too, just like you, saw Shock Treatment back many years ago on VHS. Hated it. I actually threw it at the video clerk at the video store after watching it. I said, oh, my God, we have this on your shelf. I hated it. I still hate it. But on the other hand, you mentioned William Klein in the sense that when I'm watching it for the show, I watched it 3 times because I wanted to try objectively to see what you maybe saw in it. And I couldn't see that. Maybe it's because I just don't know about enough gay rough trade stuff. I think that might be it. Yes, so you mentioned William Klein. And the thing that I was immediately reminded of in the first 10 minutes of Shock Treatment was how visually it reminded me of William Klein's Mr. Freedom.
I can totally see that. Yeah, the bright color palette and everything.
And I also probably think, and I'm sure I'm reaching, but there's also that possibility that maybe they saw Mr. Freedom, which I doubt, but because it's so similar, just the colors and the shot selection is similar too. You know, how the close up on the letter, and then there's this cut to the close up on the face at a white wall. It's just, you know, blah. I don't like Shock Treatment, but I do appreciate that aspect of it. I really appreciate the cinematography of it. I thought it was really great, but I hate the music. I hate the performances. I hate, I just feel like everyone is really, even though, you know, we know that they had a good time doing it, it feels like everyone's miserable. And it's probably because no one knew what the fuck was going on in the script. So they're just like, hey, we'll just do it and, you know, see how it turns up.
The thing that bothered me the most when I watched it the first time was the audience participation. Because I'm watching this alone in my basement, or my parents' basement, I should say. And I'm watching this movie and I know that it's a sequel to Rocky Horror and it came out like 5 years after Rocky came out, and it's really built for the audience participation. You know, I think that all the stuff that happened in Rocky with the way that people talked to the screen and everything was very organic. And the stuff that was going on in Shock Treatment, I felt like there were pauses in the film for people to scream stuff out. And the thing that really bothered me, like within the first few minutes of the movie, there's this commercial for Farley Flavors fast food something or other. And it was the five F's. And I was just like, oh God, this is the perfect opportunity for some a-hole to stand up and just yell the F word like over and over and over again.
Okay, kids, let's hear the five F's for today. F for
Farley.
F for
Flavors.
F for
Fabulous.
F for
Fast.
And F for
Fun.
First and foremost, Farley Flavors Fabulous Fast Foods feed and fortify families for a fabulous future.
So I had a hard time getting past that when I watched it. But I think that's one of the reasons why this kind of bombed, that it was set up so much like, well, if you liked Rocky Horror, you're going to love this movie. And it was such a different tone and everything. You know, just Rocky Horror is such a good parody of like, well, I don't know if parody is the right word, but such an homage to the old science fiction films that they sing about in the opening and everything. And just that kind of fish out of water. And in this case, it was just like, I don't know. It felt a lot more forced and everything. And just like the way that the songs were kind of forced to fit the situation. You know, it's like they can't really decide even who the main characters are, you know, because a lot of times I'm like, okay, this is all about Janet. This whole movie is Janet's movie. But then you have the whole Benny Monroe and the judge kind of going around. And I'm like, well, really, I guess it's more their movie at times than it is Brad and Janet's. And then Brad, I felt so bad for Cliff DeYoung. He's like, stuck in a room with a gag in his mouth for half the movie, and then the other half of the movie is playing Farley Favors, and you barely get to see the guy. You know, you see him, he's like the shadowy man in the corner kind of thing, and then he barely speaks, and then when he sings, he's the first time he's on a television set, so it's not even like you're getting the real Cliff DeYoung performance. He's just on a white stage and singing a song.
Yeah, you just pretty much justified everything I said.
Well, good. I'm glad I could do that for you.
Yeah, so I just don't understand, like, why are we talking about it? Because you like it, but you have so many things you don't like about it. It almost seems a little bit masturbatory to be talking about it. That because it's like, why don't we do a show about Transformers? Revenge of the Fallen.
Yeah, I have yet to say one good thing about the movie, other than that I like the songs. And I know you don't even like the songs, but
they're just not fun. Let me just go back to that point real fast, because when you talked about Rocky Horror, I agree with in the sense that, but Rocky Horror is fun. Like, you know right from the beginning that you're watching something really interesting and special, and the music is great. And the music is not that good. It's just not good. It's like a typical sophomore follow-up. It's not good. The songs are rushed. I mean, yeah, they're catchy. And I found myself after watching it three times in a row, I was starting to catch on to the songs a little bit. And I was like, yeah, that's not a bad song. Like, you know, the Bitchin' in the Kitchen song, and it's a horrible song, but it's catchy. It's got a pop sensibility to it. It's, you know, it's got a good swing and it can make you dance. 3 stars.
Here's some more prizes.
Don't you put the burn on me.
Look at this.
Refrigerator. Why are we always sooner or later? Bitching in the kitchen or crying in the bedroom all night. Dear knife drawer.
Stay sharp with this keen knife in hand.
Now won't you help me to face life more old.
Trash can.
Don't you put the dirt on me.
know, crying in the bedroom all night.
This show really reminds me of, like, our Dune show, where, you know, all I did on the Dune show was basically say all the reasons why people hated the movie Dune. I don't know if I necessarily did a good job defending that and saying, like, all you people are wrong, because all the criticism was valid. And I have a whole lot of criticism for this movie as well, but regardless of that, I still like it. And why do I like it? I guess I like it because I like the way that it looks, I like the songs, and I like what it's trying to say. There are problems with it, but I have a good time watching this movie, and I think that after 30 years now, it came out in 81, that after 30 years that it actually does deserve a second chance, and that people need to look at this movie and see if they can come away with something more than what was originally out there in 81. So why are you laughing over there?
Revisit it again so you can decide again that it's really bad. And then for another 30 years.
And then after 30 more years, they bring it out.
Going back to Dune, remember, I think we did a good job defending it, because remember, I received criticism from that one listener who said, did he just tell me that if I don't like Dune, I don't understand David Lynch? At least we stirred up some controversy with that show.
So we were lucky enough to talk to two of the stars of Shock Treatment, Cliff DeYoung and Jessica Harper, and we had some pretty brief discussions with them, so we're going to play them back to back.
This interview is over in 30 seconds. Roll them.
You come from a really musical background.
Yeah, in fact, we played Detroit a couple of times, Clear Light. You know, this is going back a ways, but we stayed at this place, the MC5. You know, there was this band. You might be very young. Motor City 5. The lead singer got busted for some stupid pot thing, and it was a big cause celeb. We played there, and we stayed at their house. And
so you stayed at the Panther House? I actually live 10 minutes from that house.
Do you? Yeah,
I'm very familiar
there.
With the MC5.
Well, I mean, when I say that, I mean, it wasn't we started out about, you know, 9 o'clock, and it left about 6 a.m. So then we went to the hotel. So I don't know, stayed there, but we were there a while.
But so did you just play in town, or did you play the 10th?
We played in Detroit. Yeah. We were just on the tour of Detroit.
Okay.
I think we were.
Did you play the Grandy?
I can't remember, man. That's a long time ago, but we were always second billed to somebody. I don't know who we were second billed to that time, but the MC5 guys found us and said, would you do a thing for our guy who's in jail? And we said yes.
Yeah, there was a big festival in Ann Arbor here called the 10 for 2 concert, and John Lennon came and played for him, and they got him out of prison. John Sinclair.
What was his name? What was that called?
John Sinclair.
John Sinclair, right.
Yeah. By the way, I'm actually a really big fan of Clear Light, because I've been listening to the album all week, and it's something I'd never heard before, and I've been totally grooving on it all week.
There's a good website. A guy in London has it. In fact, when we were over there doing Road to Nowhere, I met him, Gray Newell. For some reason, you know, he latched onto it. It was a fun group. I mean, I should have gone a little longer, but, you know, we were too crazy.
And you played with Hendrix, too. You toured with Hendrix, right? Or played on the Hendrix?
We opened for Hendrix. We opened for The Doors. We opened for Janis Joplin. We opened, you know, whoever was there at that time. We were the primary openers, which was part of our problem because, you know, always a bridesmaid and never a bride got us a little upset. You know, we were never the headliner.
So being around L.A., you must have ran into, I'm a huge admirer of Arthur Lee and Love. Do you ever play with
him? Yeah, he was on our label, but he was a very strange guy, you know. He was standoffish, but, you know, he was okay to talk to and stuff.
Being around L.A. and stuff, did you guys ever have any run-ins with, like, the Manson family?
I don't know. Doug Luvon wrote a book, our bass player, who then played bass for the Doors on their records, the last two Doug played on. He wrote this book that he put out on his, you know, go look at it, Doug Luvon, Lubahn. He has a whole thing in there about how I met Charles Manson and we jammed together at the Clear Lighthouse on Franklin. I have no memory of that, of ever meeting this guy. I'm sure he would have creeped me out anyway, but Doug seems to remember, so maybe it happened.
Such an amazing time in music history in the mid-60s in L.A., too.
No, it was great. It was, you know, we were having so much fun. We just thought it was going to go on forever, and it went on for a lot, you know, but then sort of everybody had to, like, go out and get a job after, because they were just signing up everybody. As soon as the California thing happened and the Doors, and, you know, it was just sign them all and hope for the best that maybe there's a couple of stars in there. So they signed us, and we toured for a year and a half, and then the record didn't do so well, so they just let us go, and everybody had to, like, go do their thing. But luckily for me, you know, we played in New York a couple of times, so when the band broke up, I went back to New York to be an actor, and that worked out okay.
So had you done acting before the band, or just kind of got into it?
In college, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Just at the college level, because, you know, we were only 22 when the band was on, so I used to play in the bars with Michael Ney and Dallas Taylor And, you know, so when they finally were forming this band, they went in with Paul Rothchild to the studio, and they made the discovery that nobody could sing in Clear Light. You know, they said, God, we've got a record deal, we've got all this. And Paul Rothchild hated all the voices. So because I played with them before, they came and got me in college. I quit college and almost went right into the studio with them. So, yeah, things happen fast, you know. I mean, you're a little dorky college kid one day, and the next day you're in New York opening for Jimi Hendrix. I don't know how that happens.
Gosh, that's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. But, you know, that's expected.
Real quick, one more last question. So what was your impression of Morrison, meeting him?
I don't know. He was a troubled guy, you know. I mean, my brother was an alcoholic, and he sort of reminded me of my brother. You know, we hung out with him a lot because we opened for him, and there was a couple of parties in New York that we were all invited to. And, you know, we were all potheads, and Jim was a drinker. So it was hard to communicate with him. He came up to me with a review one time when we were in New York and we were all at a party. And it said, Clear Light lead singer Cliff DeYoung doing his Jim Morrison imitation. And Jim said, what the hell, man? What's this? And I said, oh, fuck you, man. He was just trying to get on me. It was probably a jealousy thing, too.
On the album, did you write any of those songs?
I wrote a couple of them. The Ballad of Freddie and Larry and another one, but Mr. Blue they played Mr. Blue a lot on the radio, and so that was our big number. And as I say, we just traveled a lot.
Right, yeah, I really like Black Roses. That's like the song that really sticks out for me.
Yeah,
so
that
far,
was
yeah.
Great. Whenever I talk to the, you know, like Doug or somebody, I keep thinking, why did we do all those time changes? I mean, we're always in the middle of 4-4, and then it goes, do-dunk, do-dunk.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm saying, where did that go? Why couldn't we just finish in the time we started in? Jeez.
So how familiar were you with Rocky Horror before you took over as Brad Majors?
I saw it on the stage. Jim Sharman, the director of both Rocky Horror and Shock Treatment, he directed me in a play in New York, a musical called The Trials of Oz, about some magazine in Australia that got busted for obscenity. So I knew Jim Sharman, came to town. He asked me to come over for the original Rocky Horror show. I was doing a series called Sunshine at the time and was not available. So he put the other guy in who was pretty good, I thought. And then when the sequel came up, he called me again because Susan Sarandon and Barry Bostwick didn't want to do the sequel. So they called me and I said, sure.
Have you ever done that before where you've taken over a role that another actor had made famous? I mean, I'm sure you've done that a lot in your theater work, but have you ever done that in film?
Well, it was very scary. You know, Tim Curry is a pretty hard act to follow. I was initially kind of scared about it and not. But then you get to London and everybody's singing and dancing and jumping all over the place. And, you know, Barry Humphries became a good friend and Richard O'Brien. We still connect. When you're having that much fun, who cares? Just forget about all that. Oh, yeah, am I top billed? Am I going to be good? Am I going to be, you know, I don't know.
So which character was more enjoyable for you to play, the Brad character or the other one?
Well, you know, I forgot all about the bad guy, Farley. Yeah, Farley was great. I liked them both, you know. I mean, I wanted to play Richard's part, too. You know, let's just line me up for all of them. When we did it, you know, those guys were all pretty hot from the Rocky Horror show, so they put that together kind of quickly. And then there was an actor's strike. We were going to do it in the real Denton, Texas, with real stuff, but we couldn't do that because the actors couldn't work in the U.S. under the Screen Actors Guild, but we could work in London, so we went over to London and did it there on the stage. I just went to the first convention last year. There's a guy in town who's a big, I guess they do the Sins of the Flesh thing. They do it for the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and now I guess they got sick of doing Rocky Horror Picture Show, so they started doing Shock Treatment, the miming in front of the screen and stuff. So Jessica and I went to the convention here in Los Angeles, and we had a great time. And watched them do their thing. It was pretty cool.
Not a lot of people like Shock Treatment. Do you get a lot of flack for that?
But it was bad timing. When they released the movie around here, they released it, and then it didn't do well. So they decided they were going to release it at midnight, like the Rocky Horror. But you have to build to become a cult film. You can't just immediately. So people were kind of thought it was arrogant and stuff. And also, you know, was it a sequel? Was it not a sequel? Where's Tim Curry? So, yeah, it was kind of poo-pooed when it came out. And then slowly, you know, it built, and now people think it's pretty cool.
The thing is, the performances in the film are solid. It's just,
they are.
It's, I don't know, like, yeah, I think I'm agreeing with you on the same level that I have a hard time getting around the fact that it might be a sequel, but it might not be.
It might be, yeah. What is it?
Yeah, and I also like
the music tries too hard for me too. Like some of the songs are really good, then some of them aren't as good.
Yep, I can think of three or four they could have cut immediately.
Yeah, and you know, a Rocky Horror, like all the music is perfect.
Rocky Horror, and they also had the advantage of being in the theater for a couple of years before they filmed it. So everybody was on stage doing it 8 times a week before they got to the stage.
Exactly, because it was a play. Yeah.
So they were into it, man. They, you know, they knew how to do it. We had a week's rehearsal, and we were still trying to figure it out when we got there. So that was some kind of a disadvantage. But as I say, you know, it's 30 years ago. We had a good time. People are liking it now, and you move on. I mean, I'm so not nostalgic about my old stuff. You know, I like to keep going. So when people say, hey, that's really cool, I think, well, okay, why?
So I got to ask this, because Mike will be mad if I don't, which is, back in the early days, were you ever in Hair in New York?
Yeah, no, it's you know, because I got out of the band, I went to New York to be an actor, and Hair was the job that you could get.
Nice.
And it would support you while you're out trying to do your other little stuff.
Yeah, we've done so many interviews in the last 2 weeks where we've talked to people and they were all in Hair in New York in the 70s.
I mean, it ran forever, uh-huh. You know? I mean, it was like 4 years or something, and it just coincided with the 5 years that I lived in New York. So whenever you were out of work, you'd go knock on the door and say, you know, you need somebody in the chorus or you need somebody to play, and they'd say, yeah, come on.
When I see your name in the credits of anything or when I see you pop up in something, it's just like, I want to yell at the screen, like, don't trust that guy. He's going to screw you over.
Yeah, I know. I've been used in that way. I guess I'm getting a little, yeah. Whenever we see you, we know it's not going to turn out well.
Yeah, you even tried to screw over RoboCop, man. Come on, you know? Detroit's hero.
Well, that was RoboCop the series. Actually, I was very good at that RoboCop the series. I was real happy with it. Well, okay, boys. I got to go.
Again, once more she's gone, but then it's better to be free. You missed her, you needed her, but that should never be. And now I'm crying inside to myself. I didn't see what she'd done to me. She locked my mind.
Phantom of the Paradise is really early in your career. Can you tell me how you got into the acting stuff?
I was in college and not particularly happy, and I was taking a theater course, and my mother, of all people, called me and told me that they were having open auditions for the cast of Hair in New York, and she suggested I go and audition for it, which I thought was a little insane because I'd never done such a thing in my life, never had a job. But I went downtown to this church in New York where there were 500 hippies lined up around the block with their guitars waiting to audition for the show, and I joined them and I got a part in the show. So I was on Broadway in Hair, my very, very, very first job. So it was just one of those serendipity things. So I was in the show for about a year, and then I went on and did a bunch of other theater off Broadway and regional theater as well, and eventually landed in an off-Broadway show called Dr. C'est la Vie's Magic Theater that was directed by Richard Foreman, and it was a big hit off-Broadway. So a lot of people in New York came to see it, including Brian De Palma and Woody Allen's producer came, and various people saw it, and from there that triggered a lot of activity in movies, including, you know, a meeting with Paul Williams for Phantom of the Paradise, and later a meeting with Woody Allen, and so on and so forth. So that's how I got started. And it was from that Off-Broadway show that I got, as I say, I went to meet with Paul Williams. And ultimately, I was flown out to Hollywood to do a screen test, just like they used to do in the old days, and to meet with Brian. And I was competing against Linda Ronstadt, which made me very nervous, but I got the part. And then it just goes on from there.
Were you a big Rocky Horror fan in the 70s?
No, not really. I mean, I thought that it was fine and adorable, but I wasn't going to the midnight screenings. I mean, it was, I just thought it was kind of cool. I wasn't a big, huge fan or anything.
They shot Phantom in Dallas, right?
Yes.
And then they were going to shoot Shock Treatment in Texas as well, right?
Yeah, well, that's where it supposedly takes place, but they shot it in London instead, thank God. London is so much more fun than Texas. No offense to Texas, but... No, the truth of the matter is I just this year have spent a great deal of time in Texas because I was on a book tour and I went to 4 different cities, and I found Texas very interesting. So I don't mean to diss Texas by any means, especially Austin is fabulous, I think. But I love London more, frankly. So I was really happy to work on that movie in London. To do Shock Treatment there was fantastic.
Now, had you ever done a movie that was completely on a soundstage before? Because I imagine you did a lot of locations with your other work, especially with Suspiria.
Yeah, I did one that was all in one set, a movie that was all in one set for 3 weeks. And, well, Suspiria was, we did those exteriors in Munich. But, no, I guess that was the only other one that was all in one set. It was also in England. So... yeah, just once before.
How does that change the experience, or is there really no difference for you?
It's easier, obviously, to shoot on a set where you have control over sound and light and temperature and everything else. You know, you just get through it much faster. Being outside on location, you're subject to all kinds of things that are out of your control. So it takes a little bit longer, but it's kind of fun. Like in Suspiria, we shot in the Black Forest and the airport in the rain and all those gorgeous places in Munich. It was really special to be able to just be in some of the most beautiful places in Germany that were also beautifully lit by Dario. So it was kind of magical.
When you did Shock Treatment, did you do a lot of research for the role? I'm curious if you had watched Rocky and how your experience is taking over a character, or if you didn't even think about that.
I didn't really think about it too much. I mean, I had seen Rocky, but I did not go back and watch more of it. I don't know. I think I felt like I shouldn't be watching Susan Sarandon too much because it might confuse me. I just sort of, you know, figured I would do the character as I saw fit and hope everybody would just go with the whatever connection there was between the two of us. There wasn't. That was pretty much all I did. And then I just wanted to do the character on my own terms and sing it the way I wanted to sing it and behave the way I felt I should behave. It's also the character in Shock Treatment does go through a radical change, which is very different from what happens to the character in Rocky Horror. And I had the advantage of not having to sit around in my underwear for most of the movie, which poor Susan, I heard, was not too happy about.
You got some great outfits in Shock Treatment.
I got that wonderful pink polyester suit that I loved, and they did a great job on the costumes. That black dress, and it was all fun.
Yeah, and you had a lot of, you know, standout acts. I mean, the whole you coming out of your shell and just taking over the world, that scene is awesome.
Oh, right. Yeah, I got to act out some great fantasies there.
There with your guitar and everything, that was pretty cool.
I loved it. I loved that I got to be a rock for 3 minutes or whatever it was. It was wonderful. It was great.
So what was your whole experience shooting that? I mean, was it weird coming in because you've got some of the actors who had worked together for so long? Was there like any kind of like weird clicky stuff, or did they just kind of welcome you into the family?
No, they were really, really sweet, all of them. And as you say, of course, they'd worked together and they're all very close. But being a little bit of an outsider was kind of suitable for the role. But I have to say they were very warm. Richard O'Brien and Nell Campbell, I mean, they couldn't have been nicer. Barry Humphries is an incredible gentleman. We had a great time together, the cast. And Clifty Young, of course, was also a newcomer to the Rocky scene. And he's a really sweet man and a wonderful actor. So he was great to work with, you know. And then he and I were, of course, with the Americans in London. So we spent a fair amount of time together outside of shooting. You know, he was there with his wife and I was there with a friend, and you know, we just kind of hung out a lot. We had a great time. We had just a wonderful time. It's just a great group of people, the Rocky Horror group. Really in sync with each other, really interesting sensibilities, really smart people, and really kind. So It was all pretty terrific. But I have actually been really lucky that way. A lot of really good experiences. A couple that weren't so great, but we don't need to talk about them. We had a great time recording it, though. Oh my! I think Richard did a great job on the music. I loved singing that stuff. I had a terrible, the day after we finished recording, I came down with this horrible, thank God I was done, came down with this horrible virus, and I was dead for a couple of weeks, but luckily squeezed in that last vocal right before I collapsed. This always happens when you go to England. You get about 24 hours in, and you get a terrible cold.
What are the differences between the fans there? What have you noticed with that?
Between Shock Treatment and Phantom?
Right.
The fans of Shock Treatment are fewer, I believe, than they are. I mean, the Phantom of the Paradise fans are, I think there are quite a lot of them. And they are really, well, first of all, Shock Treatment is sort of rides on the coattails of Rocky Horror Show. And I think the fans of Shock Treatment are really first and foremost Rocky Horror fans. Phantom, of course, kind of stands on its own. And the people who are devoted to Phantom are really fanatical. They're just mad for it. Interestingly, I think the fan base for Shock Treatment was slow to develop and now is growing exponentially for some reason. Maybe it's partly because of the internet, partly because of a lot of these conventions and so forth. Rocky Horror fans are attaching themselves more and more, I think, to Shock Treatment as well. But Phantom has its own original base, and I get a lot of email and, you know, contacts on Facebook from Phantom, much more so, I think, than from Shock Treatment.
What I've read of the reviews wasn't really that well liked.
No, people didn't much like Shock Treatment. I think Phantom of the Paradise, I don't know that the reviews were fabulous. It didn't make a lot of money by any means. It didn't open very strong at all, but I think the critics might have been a little kinder to Phantom of the Paradise. There's so much wonderful Brian De Palma-isms in that movie, I think that people liked it to a greater degree than they liked Shock Treatment. I think that got pretty trashed, as I recall, by the critics.
I have to ask about the cookbook.
It's a collection of humor and recipes and survival tips for people who don't always experience the joy of cooking. I consider myself a crabby cook because I cooked for my very picky family for over 20 years. I guess what happened was a few years ago, I was doing a lot of writing, and I just started writing some stories that I thought were quite amusing about family feeding, and not just my own family, but stories about my childhood as well, and what my mother had to put up with when she was feeding her family. And I just started thinking this would be a book that I would like to write. So I started collecting stories and collecting recipes and put this thing together. So anyway, it's meant to be fun. It's funny. It's and loaded with recipes that are pretty easy for the most part, but it's all very fresh, healthy food. It's not, you're not going to find a lot of condensed soup or, you know, that prefab food that a lot of us use for cooking for shortcuts. It's not like that. It's not that easy. But it's pretty simple recipes with a little touch of sophistication, I think. But mostly the recipes are crowd pleasers because I've been cooking for picky people for so long. I just hone down my list of recipes to those that appeal to the most people.
Your website is thecrabbycook.com.
Right, yes, thecrabbycook.com. And my second website is jessicaharper.com.
There's just the two of me, alone at last together. We've got the luck so far. We are my lucky stars, 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 stars. In the heart of me, I love every part of me. All I can see in me is danger and ecstasy. One thing there couldn't be is any more me in me. This is the me of me.
So yeah, that was absolutely bizarre. It was great talking to Cliff DeYoung, but it was just bizarre how quickly it ended. It was like, it got to like the 30-minute mark, and it was like, okay, boys, good talking to you. Take care.
I think you creeped him out.
I creeped him out. You were the one who was obsessing about Rick Dean. You know, like, hey, you worked with Rick Dean.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. I already forgot about it, actually. That's how traumatized that was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But the thing that I found hilarious, and we cemented it with Cliff and Jessica, was that we have talked to a lot of people that have been in the musical Hair. We talked to Alan Nichols, Deborah Van Valkenburg. I'm trying to remember who all else that we've talked to, but it seemed like
a lot.
Yeah, Dolph Lundgren was in Hair.
I am Spetsnaz.
Tobar Mayo was in Hair.
Yeah. Steve Railsback and Richard Rush was in Hair.
Yeah, that's
too,
right.
Exactly, in 1931.
Yeah, Steve Railsback out there singing and dancing and stuff. I can just imagine it. Yeah, we've just talked to so many people, and it seems like it's such a trend. And then I love how the first thing Jessica is like, oh, yeah, well, then I went to New York, and I was in Hair, and it's like, oh, my God. Were you guys all in this thing at the same time? It's like, okay, and on stage tonight, we've got Meatloaf, Alan Nichols, Cliff DeYoung, and Jessica Harper all in Hair. And Deborah Van Valkenburg.
And Richard Rush.
Hopefully, we'll hear some more from Jessica on the Phantom of the Paradise show that we're still working on here. But it was strange, too, because like neither of them had any kind of stories about like the making of it. You know, like you some of these guys, you interview them, and it's like, oh yeah, let me tell you all about this. This was great, and we did this, and we did that, and we had this great time, and you know, let me tell you something about, you know, what it was like actually being on the set and stuff. I'm thinking about like Winter and or even like Wings Hauser and stuff, and it's just like you say go, and these guys are just chatting and telling you all this stuff. Sometimes stuff you don't even want to know, and sometimes just absolutely bizarro shit where you're just like, wow, you know, this is, where did this come from? But with these guys, it was just like, so how was it working on Shock Treatment? Oh, it was fun.
I'm telling you, it's because no one knew what the hell that movie was about. They're just like, learn these songs, get in this costume, and go. No one knows what that movie's about. No one. You think you know what it's about, but no one knows. You know what's funny in Shock Treatment, though, is going back to your thing about how they were trying to play off the first Rocky Horrors. Did you notice how it seemed like every time Patricia Quinn would walk into the room, she would go, hoopla!
Yeah, they over-hoopla in that movie. Oh, my God. But I should say that I love Barry Humphries in this movie. I thought that he was terrific. And then the one thing that I really liked about him, I know you probably hated him, but the thing that I liked about him was, you know, how he's so smiley and everything on camera. And then as soon as the cameras go off, his smile just immediately goes away. I liked that. And I loved his outfit. And it was kind of weird, that whole, like, is he blind? Is he not blind? And
I don't even know what he was. Was he human? Like, he's not even like, I hate him.
Wow.
I wanted to stab him in the face.
Jeez, don't hurt
I really,
that.
I just, he's, yeah, there's, that is one, probably the most hated characters in movie history for me. Wow. I just don't like him.
Wowee, okay.
I just don't like this movie, except Patricia Quinn. She's hot.
All right, fair enough.
Ever since I was a little boy, dressing up has always been my greatest joy. But when it's time to be discreet, there's one thing you just can't beat.
And that's a strapless, backless, classical little black dress. Well, first you go rip, rip, rip. Then you go snip, snip, snip. Then you whip it a zip, zip, zip. I split it up to the hip, hip, hip. And as you strip, strip, strip,
you shiver and quiver
for that soft caress as you slip, slip, slip into that little black dress.
Ever since I was the Eine Kleine Herren, it was the cordon bleu for which I am most caring. And the one taste treat so sweet that really came to be beat is what we have, yeah, how you are, caviar, that little black mess.
Well, first you go rip, rip, rip. Then you go snip, snip, snip. Then you whip in a zip, zip, zip. Split it up to the hip, hip, hip. Then as you strip, strip, strip. Oh, you quiver, you shiver. For that soft dress as you slip, slip, slip into that little black dress. That minimal.
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 Cynical.
Little black.
All right, well, I am actually still thrilled at the prospect of seeing Shot Treatment on the big screen and a really nice plush theater and everything. And I
alone.
Alone, yeah. It's, you know, it's going to be par for the fucking course with my book tour. So, yeah, if no one shows up, it'll be more people than I had at some of the stops on the book tour. So I'll just say that. Hopefully, I've managed to spark enough interest to get people to come out May 27th to the Tribeca Theater, put on by 92Y. And if nothing else, please just check out the soundtrack album because I don't think you'll be disappointed. So
you will be.
Wow. Jeez. You're pretty much sabotaging my whole book tour thing, kickoff thing. But
hi, well, we'll start it over then.
Hello. I'm Dr. Cosme McKinley.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
Hi, this is Albert Kuhn, and I'm here in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
That's all we have time for this week. Be sure to tune in next week for our show all about Wingshauser's The Art of Dying. In the meantime, be sure to visit our website, projection-booth.com, for extra goodies. And, you know, maybe you can go on iTunes, give us some stars and stuff, whatever. And don't forget to vote for the projection booth at the GoldenCobAwards.com. So,
well, let me just comment about the iTunes thing. We've been sitting at 30 stars for a week now. I'm getting really irritated. So we need to be at 60 stars by the end of this week, or I'm cracking skulls.
Sounds like a challenge. And don't forget to email Justin. Every time a person buys a VHS of Stripteaser, Justin will donate 25 cents towards the Japanese Relief Fund. So,
and I have donated 75 cents so far.
So keep it coming, folks. Keep ordering those copies of Stripteaser. And Justin will donate 1/10 of the price of any copy of the novelization of Freaked that gets sold. So save your receipt and send that over to
Justin. That's good, because there's only six of those left.
Exactly. We're topping out at, what, $2? Maybe 50 cents. So.
I can afford that.
Excellent. So let's get out of here with a cover of the Shock Treatment theme song by a band called Transsexual Glamour.
I'm
Okay, boys. I gotta go.